When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey everyone, hope you've had a great week so far. We are really excited to bring you an episode. So Sebastian, I want to know, we've talked a little bit about camping and things before, but if you were to go camping, do you choose to go glamping? Or are you like ultra like crazy backpacking man? Like which, where do you go if you're going camping?
Yeah, that's a good question. I love that. I love these questions. I would say I'm actually a by person taste here. So I love the raw nature. It's gonna suck camping. And I do also love glamping at the same time. So I truly enjoy both. I've done both and I enjoy both of them. I would say that it's just a function of who I'm going with. So I think the more I am by myself, no, actually that's not true. I think, yeah, there's some people who I would not go glamping and I wouldn't like go rough camping and then vice versa. Yeah. What about you?
So I guess similar to you, right? Like I've done both of them. I like being farther away from people when I'm like outside. And sometimes when you go like glamping, the place looked nice, but it's like drivable. So there are people all around.
Yeah.
But for our honeymoon, we did like the ultimate combo of the two. We stayed at this like place in the middle of like Argentina and like in the middle of nowhere, but it was like fancy place that was like very far away. So the one time in my life I did both.
Those are nice.
What about you, Donna? Are you a camping person at all? And if so, do you prefer the like outdoor wilderness alone or the like yurt?
I've camped, but I grew up on a farm. And so if you grow up on a farm, why camp? Right. I'm a glamper. We for vacation will be renting a house up in Ely, Minnesota, up in the Boundary Waters. Rent cabins on lakes and then we get a boat and go fish. Have a shower and
toilet
and fun things like that. So yeah, definitely a glamper, although in the past we camped when we motorcycle vacation.
That is super fun. Can we learn more about that? That sounds like, do you take all your things with you?
You can demarcate by before children and after children.
BC and AAC, right?
Yeah, my kids are teenagers now, but before children, every vacation I took with my husband, besides our honeymoon, was on a motorcycle.
Wow, that's so cool.
For my first sabbatical, we rode our Harleys from St. Louis to Maine, across the northern United States to Seattle, down the west coast to San Francisco, back to Yellowstone. So we rode 10,500 miles in 5.5 weeks.
That's very into that. That I have to say, like I create, you know, my biases. I would not have expected that.
So I had a Harley Sportster. And I had to lower it because I'm vertically challenged. So
that's right.
But I after I had children, it collected dust in the garage for several years.
You didn't have like the sidecar with your kids in it or anything? I'm not sure. No.
Have your kids adopted this passion?
No. So, you know, my husband still has his Harley. He has an electric rod. But yeah, no, the kids haven't really gotten into motorcycles.
That's so funny because that's like have to be like that. That has to be like if you're, you know, children don't ever think you're cool. You're like, yeah, but have you ever done this? You know.
We used to specialize in dangerous hobbies.
That's awesome.
Well, as you have heard so far, our special guest today is Donna Günther, who is the Roy A. Roberts Distinguished Professor of Economics and Director of the Institute for Policy and Social Research at the University of Kansas. She's also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Major fields of study are scientific labor markets, gender differences in employment outcomes, wage inequality, scientific entrepreneurship, children's educational outcomes and child abuse and neglect. So a broad range of super important social topics there. Donna, thank you so much for being with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, thank you. So you've already shared with us a very fun fact, and maybe it's not possible to follow up on, but are there any additional shareable fun facts you'd love to share?
So that's the one that kind of stands out. You know, there were actually three labor economists, me, Hank Farber, and Eddie Lazier, who were motorcyclists. Eddie passed away last year, but you know, Eddie and Hank have BMWs, and I had a Harley.
Wow! Did you guys have like a team name, like the Motorcycle Bureau of Economic Research (MBER)?
No, but we did have some good conversations at the NBER Summer Institute about the bikes to ride.
That's so cool. That is awesome.
Yeah.
So in addition to a shareable fun fact, we'd love to know if there's any paper or work or anything else that you'd love to promote.
I do have two forthcoming papers that would be of interest to your audience in the Papers and Proceedings about gender in the economic profession. One was a follow-up study about the CMET mentoring workshop when we found that women who attended the workshop have larger collaborative networks, but it's not with the people who attended the workshop. Mm-hmm. So we interpret that finding to show that actually having the mentoring treatment gave them some tacit knowledge that influenced their careers. Mm. And as you know, co-authors are important in terms of increasing the number of citations and increasing your number of publications. So having collaborative networks is very positive for your careers. And the treated women had three more collaborators.
Wow. That's a lot.
The effect was huge.
I would say, given that they're junior scholars, three is like a huge percentage point increase, correct?
Exactly. Very large.
And the collaborators are juniors and seniors, or just one mix?
We haven't really looked at the, you know, the relative ranking of the collaborators.
That's so interesting that it's not people from the workshop. Because that's immediately where my brain went. So I wonder if it's like connections that they make through their mentors or through the other peers, you know, that they're getting.
We don't really fully understand the mechanism. I've been thinking about actually asking NSF for more money to study this. Right?
There you go.
And in the same ERPMP, we have Shu Khan and I have a paper looking at gender differences in promotion using more recent data. And economics of the disciplines that we consider is the only field that has a gender gap in promotion after controlling for publication citations and grants. But then we separated it by the ranking of the institution. And we found that at the very top institutions, there's not a promotion gap. But if you look down, if you look at sort of like research high institutions, that's where you see the gap emerging, which we find is very provocative as well.
Wow.
I don't have like a good prior on this, but for some reason, my prior was like the opposite. I'm not quite sure why I had that feeling, but.
I think it's a prior in the literature, right? It could be what's happening is, you know, our results are different from what the literature has found. And it could be, we're looking at whether or not they're tenured. It could be that the literature is looking at whether or not they're tenured at their institution, right? So maybe you don't get tenured at Chicago, but you get tenured at Wisconsin, for example.
Oh, I missed that subtlety. I'm sorry, when you first said this.
Yeah, so we're just looking tenure, yes, no. We're not looking at tenure at the institution that you start at.
Right? Okay.
So there could be some subtleties there.
Could you look at time to tenure?
Yeah, we could. We're estimating hazard models, which are
in I see.
Tenure. But we could definitely calculate years.
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow. As I always say, like, unfortunately, this is not a research podcast because I feel like we would just could talk about this for a while. It's super interesting research agenda. But I'm sure that if people go to your website, they could find more on that research that you're doing.
Yeah, definitely.
We'd love to know a little bit about the workflow. You have a huge number of publications, both on important topics, but in important places. You have a personal life. You do all sorts of awesome things. You have a ton of students that you've advised. So how do you do all of this? Is there like a secret to your success or
what type of coffee do you drink? You know,
yeah, when you know the beans, the roast, all of it, whatever you think matters.
Well, so you know, because of COVID, my workflow increased 50% because I decided to take on talk. Yeah, I noticed that nobody in the state of Kansas was actually tracking what was happening to the economy with respect to COVID. So I have a staff. So I have I direct this institute and I have staff and data people. I said, you know, we should really start tracking what's happening in Kansas with respect to the disease, the Kansas economy, and whatnot. So we started doing a lot of work tracking COVID and the COVID economy. And I started doing briefings about what was happening to the economy because, you know, it has happened in the middle of teaching and it was unprecedented in our lifetimes what was happening to the economy. So I thought, well, you know, this is filler for teaching my classes. And so I started, you know, having a lecture on econometrics, but then a lecturing, oh, you know, here's the unemployment rate. We've never seen anything like this before in April 2020, right? So my work has increased. You know, what happens is that when you can't go anywhere, you can get a lot of work done. but in general, my workflow is...
And when you don't have childcare responsibilities or some type of...
So I have teenagers, right?
Yeah,
and so teenagers don't always need you to talk to them. In fact, they kind of get annoyed if you ask them questions sometimes. So COVID happened at a time where, you know, I was ideally positioned to just be locked in my home office and work. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, that creates problems in and of itself because I don't know if this happens to you, but I get diminishing returns to work.
Yes.
And that's why I've always said that parenthood made me better at my job. Because, you know, I would put my kids in daycare and work. Right. And then be really able to focus and then play with my kids, have a break. And then, you know, in the evening, if I had other stuff to do, do work again. But now that they're older and everything, all I do is work. So my workflow, you know, because I have an administrative job, I have to take meetings. I have a lot of meetings. So I try to protect 2 days a week, Monday and Friday.
Okay.
So that I can have more blocks of free time. And you know, if I were in a general, if it were a normal semester, we have teaching days and research days. And so everything related to teaching has to go on a teaching day and everything related to research has to go on the research days.
So your Monday and Fridays are your research days?
So Monday and Fridays, I do research, but since, you know, there's nothing else to do, I do research on weekends, I do research in the evening. When I can. But if this were a normal world and not COVID world, I would have teaching days and research days. And so I would try to force every meeting I possibly could onto my teaching days. So those days are all full of meeting with people and sharing with class.
Right.
And talking
you to mean students. Wonderful because you're talking to so many people that you want.
I use the phrase when I'm talking with my wife about this. This is like pre-COVID. So I live like an hour and a half away from, depending on traffic, an hour and a half away from where I teach. So I would do the same thing, but by necessity. I would be like, on my teaching days, I need all the meetings. I'd be like, this is basically lighting my day on fire. I can do nothing else other than these meetings. But it created the system sort of accidentally that you're describing. And I found that the days where I would remain at home and do research were like fantastically productive because I had no... things sort of coming up in the middle.
Exactly. And then the other thing I do is you need to know yourself and know where your brain works well. Right? So I am not a morning person. So I got up, I had to take my daughter to school. I went back to bed for a half hour.
Oh, wow.
I'm not a morning person.
That's awesome.
you know, but so, you know, we have a lot of stuff to do. So like email in the morning is good for me because it doesn't require as much attention. Later in the day, in the evening, I can focus. And so that's when I try to put those mentally intensive tasks, knowing where I, you know, some people are morning people, right? And so they should focus their research in the morning and other stuff like email in the evening when they're not as productive.
I'm so glad to hear you say this, because we had someone on the podcast who I entirely believe recently, but who wakes up at 4 a.m. every day and does their work. And I was just like, you sound like a fictitious, like Instagram motivator or something to me. Like, this seems impossible to me. I think I'm more like you. We're like, it seems later in the day I can work.
So, I typically, you know, after dinner, will do work and work until midnight.
Really? Oh, that's surprising, actually. But that's like every other day or every day?
I would say 4 days a week.
Wow.
I will, after dinner, after spending time with my family, I will, you know, come back to my office and do work.
Oh, okay.
Like, I was working on a referee report or a revisory submit for journal.
And you don't get, I guess you said you spend time with your family. I was going to say, you don't get like crap from your family being like, well, what are you doing? You know, going back to your office so late.
We're unusual. My husband has been telecommuting since the 1990s.
Whoa.
So he works out of the house.
Wow.
24/7 has, you know, he started on a modem. His company. High speed internet now. So this is absolutely no change for him, other than the fact that more people are home.
Right. It's more annoying for him, right?
I used to be able to lay out.
The kids are used to their parents working. So.
And what about the weekends? Is the weekends the time when you relax, or the weekends also kind of work time?
Well, COVID, because you can't do anything, I work, right?
Okay.
My daughter plays competitive soccer, so I used to do weekend soccer mom things.
Oh, that's awesome. That is cool.
Yeah. So my kids are like my leisure. So, there's this Becker literature about whether kids are consumption goods or production goods. My kids are consumption goods. So.
Okay. do you care if they hear that or they're accepted that that's the case?
They're interested in economics. So like my son does debate, and so I give him the economic issues of the debate topic.
Okay.
Or my daughter's like has been quizzing me about the minimum wage.
Oh wow, right? That's interesting. Yeah,
that's so fulfilling sounding to hear that one day my kids might repeat back the jargon I spilled to them in a way that like you internalized some of this. Like, that's amazing.
My husband was an undergraduate economics major. He's a computer scientist now, but so we talk about this stuff, right? So they get it by osmosis.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for sharing your workflow. That was very interesting and really, I think, a little bit different from what we hear from different people. So I like the variety of that.
It made me really happy. I work at night too, so you're like one of the first people that are like described a similar like I get a lot of work done during that same time period.
One of the lessons I've been getting from doing this question with a lot of different people is that, which is so obvious, there's no single path to success, right? Which is like obvious when you hear it, but then when you see it as every single different example, it's like so tangible that that's truly the case. So I like that.
Well, I want to mention, I used to organize, in addition to studying the CMIT workshop, I ran the workshop and I participated was involved with four of the first workshops. Mm. And, you'd always ask, people would always ask about work-life balance, right? Mm-hmm. And they get really upset about it. And just like, you have to figure out what works for you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you have to know yourself in order to know when you can do your work and what works for you. It's, what works for me won't necessarily work for anybody else.
Totally.
Sometimes it doesn't even work for me.
Right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that. Right. And sometimes it actually even doesn't work for me. So you have to change it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to say, this isn't working.
So today we want to talk about how, if we can provide some help tips or understanding on how to get research funding. So obviously this is a broad topic and it could be interesting for many people. And there's lots of things to talk about and probably won't be able to cover them all, but we just kind of start to get our feet wet with this topic. Can you tell us just in general, maybe what is a grant and what is some of that terminology involved and why would someone get it?
Okay. So what is a grant? Well, it's funding for your research project. And there are different types of grants from different organizations. and different sets of rules. So the National Science Foundation funds most of economic research. And so what happens is you submit a proposal to the NSF economics panel. Then the program officer at the NSF sends that proposal out for review. She has a panel of specialists, about 10 people, who will review all the proposals that were submitted for that round. But about 4 or 5 people, and maybe some outsiders, if they have expertise, will write a review mm-hmm. of that proposal. The 10 people will get together and talk about all of the proposals mm. and then rank them in terms of whether or not they're competitive. Mm. And in NSF, it's excellent, very good, good, fair, poor. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then you get, you know, rankings from the review panel, and you order them, and then the proposals are funded.
Right.
But the proposal is submitted by your sponsored research office at the university. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can't send it to NSF on your own.
Yeah.
So you need to talk to your sponsored research office. And I direct an institute where we do everything for our PIs except write the proposal. So we handle the budget.
Fantastic.
We proofread awesome. The proposal. We make sure that you have all of your documents in order. It's reviewed at our sponsored research office that pushes send. Mm. Now, there's a thing called overhead. Mm-hmm. All right. And that is money that the federal government tops off your grant for. Right. Mm-hmm. So the overhead rate at the University of Kansas is like 51%, and that's to cover the costs of the research facilities and the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So you have a direct cost, like your summer salary or support for research assistants or buying data. And then the total amount of the grant for me would be 51% of that value would be added on.
51%. So
51%, and our overhead is low for a research university. Go ahead.
So I have a question about this. Could you explain I was totally unaware of this idea of what overhead is, or basically like you need to like the grant you apply for will basically be what you need times two. And as I sort of submitted grants and learned about strategy here, I learned that different people, one person might be able to submit a grant through different institutions at which they have different overhead, not just amounts, but incentives tied to perhaps getting some of that overhead back in a way. Could you walk through that in a at a high level for people who have maybe not heard it before?
There are different negotiations at each university. So overhead rate is determined by the federal government, and it's the amount of buildings, it's the number of staff. So it's covering the institutional costs of having funded research. So the dirty secret about economists.
I love it. Hidden curriculum stuff. Go for it.
is that we make money for the university. Mm. We have an office and a computer. and a graduate student, maybe.
Right.
Or a postdoc, right? So we don't have a lab that requires maintenance. We don't have, you know, $1 million instruments that are really expensive to buy and manage. So any money that we bring in is subsidizing the sciences. Mm. So a university should be really happy if their social scientists are right. getting money, because that is subsidizing the real expenses.
Because it's the same kind of like overhead percentage for everyone.
The overhead is the same. Right. But so the overhead rates, like if you submit an education grant to IES, their overhead rate, because nobody has a lab in education, is like 15%.
Right? Oh, okay. Wow.
So the overhead is much lower because they're all sort of like using secondary data or whatever. So they're not expensive.
Can you make like an example with $100?
So if you submit $100 total grant,
yeah,
right, in my overhead world of Kansas, I get $50 in direct costs. And then the overhead is split between our office of research, the college, and the department. The department gives me all of my money. I get extra overhead from my
interesting.
Any funded grant. Interesting.
And ours is similar at the school that I'm in at IU, where basically if I submit a grant and I need $51, and then I end up submitting a $100 grant and I'm successful, I'd get that $51 for my grant purposes. But then some share of that overhead I would receive in a research account for me to be used later on for potentially unrelated to that grant purposes, right? And if I submit the grant through, I'm like a member of another institute on campus, I may receive potentially more of my overhead back or less of my overhead back. So that's how some of these institutes can come and crop up and become competitive by getting you to submit your grants through them.
And so the overhead, you know, is a way to fund the federal government, fund research at the university. Right.
What is your background on the topic of research funding, and what are the perspectives that you're bringing to that conversation?
Well, so I direct the Institute for Policy and Social Research, and we help faculty at the University of Kansas get research funding. So I'm in the job of helping other people get funding. I got the job because I've been successful at getting funding, and I can tie my success at funding back to the first mentoring workshop that was funded by the National Science Foundation in 1998 when I was an assistant professor, and Dan Newland, who was the NSF Econ program officer, was there. He funded the workshop when he was there, and they had a session on getting grants, and they said, if you want a grant, you need to talk to your program officer about your idea.
Okay.
And they can kind of give you some suggestions. And then the second thing I learned at that workshop was that the best way to be successful in writing a proposal was to see a successful proposal. And so they circulated successful grant proposals. So I was able to see what success looked like. And then I wrote grants. And, you know, you may not get it on the first try, but one of the things, I also study science funding.
And
so my research on science policy is all about who gets money. How does the review process work? What is the impact of funding? And so if you, there's a huge dose response to resubmitting. So especially if you look at the National Institutes of Health, right? Chances are you won't get it on the first time. You'll get comments. You go back and you resubmit.
With the same topic, you mean?
Same topic, you take the comments, you incorporate the comments, you submit a revision, and you're much more likely to be funded.
Oh, interesting.
My first big NSF grant was a second. It was a do-over. So you get your comments on the grant, and you look over them. And then you call a program officer again. And you say, what do you think? You know, how did the review panel, you know, what do you, of these comments that I got, which is the most important? I had to go three times to get my first NIH grant, and I wasn't going to go the second time, but at the third time. But then I got an email from the program officer, and she said, call me. And I said, I called her, and she's like, oh, you're so close. You just have to do this, this, and this. And so I got it on the third time.
Wow.
So there's a whole bunch of unwritten rules about how to submit a proposal. And so you need to ask your network about what's outwards.
I guess I have a clarifying question here. So I was told a similar thing. I didn't get an NSF grant, and I like was kind of, I like sent it to a senior colleague. I was like, why didn't I get this? And like, why? They basically were like, why did you expect to get your first NSF grant? I don't understand why you're even remotely upset. But they also suggested that I contact, like, you know, people that effectively, to me, it's like kind of like contacting the reviewer, right? But do you think this type of contact is acceptable across all types of grants, or is this limited to like the large NSF and NIH grants? Because it just felt a little bit to me, it made me uncomfortable because it felt like I was kind of like reaching out to my reviewer, but obviously that's wrong. So it's like good information to hear that this is okay to do.
The program officer is not the reviewer. They manage the process.
I guess I misunderstand how the grants are approved. In my mind, it was like maybe like they're like the editor. So I've clearly misunderstood something.
So the program officer at NSF,
okay,
the head econ program officer at NSF is Nancy Lutz. She runs a review panel of other economists who review your proposal. And you'll get a, if you've submitted an econ proposal, you'll get about 4 or 5 reviews of your proposal and a rating. And then you'll have a panel discussion of all of the proposals submitted at econ, and they're ranked. And then Nancy goes in order. Nancy sits in on all of those discussions. Your proposal, you'll get the ad hoc reviews. So you'll get about 4 reviews. And if it's discussed, then you'll get a summary of the discussion comments. So the summary of the discussion comments will say, well, this was good. It's lacking here. And it may list a whole bunch of things that you could fix, right? If I did that, I read, you know, I got a proposal summary that said I was close, but not quiet or not competitive. I'd read over the comment, determine whether or not it's fixable, and then call back, call Nancy or the other econ program officer who handled the handled my proposal and say, so I see they were concerned about this in my proposal. They're concerned about my identification strategy. Do you think if I, you know, tried a different approach or different data, that might fly with the panel more or not? And so they can kind of say, well, you know, the panel, didn't like the topic or the you know, that would be bad news. But the panel, you know, they can kind of give you, help you interpret the written comments.
Gotcha. I have two clarifying questions. When you say resubmit, you mean like, the way I think of grants is like, submit your grant by, you know, September 1st of 2021. Right. When you say resubmit, you mean like the next year or you
the
mean?
Next year.
Okay, the next year. So you do, there is some process of waiting. And then the second thing is, do they ever reject you based on budget? And what I mean by that is, I know that grants, you have to like say, like, this is how I'm going to use the money. And I'm always worried about that because I wonder if I'm doing something wrong about that. So I don't know if that's something that affects the criteria of rejecting or not.
If you have an outrageous budget, but a good proposal, they'll say, no, we're not going to give you this. We're not going to give you $1 million. We'll give you $300,000. So adjust your, but again, you want to talk to your program officer before you submit, because NSF says they'll provide 2 summer months of funding, but that summer funding is capped at a certain amount. So if you put in over that, you're wasting everybody's time. So you need to know, you know, they won't buy computers anymore, for example. You know, how much is acceptable for travel? Those type of budget issues, again, the program officer can provide guidance to you.
You kind of already alluded to this, but I wanted to dig more into is, talk to your program officer, which I think it's great advice. I personally, I applied to grants before, never done that. So I feel kind of dumb. But the second thing is look at, you know, successful applications. And I learned from those. And sometimes, to be honest, I feel like I wasn't learning because I'm like, I read something and I'm like, well, of course this is going to get funded because it was so impactful. Do you think there is something also to learn from applications that didn't get the funding? To maybe kind of like assess, you know, like, okay, this is, these are the components that are different from this other one?
Yeah, so there's one other thing that I want to sort of interject here, which is really, you know, and program officers won't tell you this. These organizations fund projects where they can see that it's going to be successful. So they don't fund ideas. So you need pilot studies, you need a model written down, you need a lot of detail so that the people reviewing the proposal can see that it's going to be successful. When I came to the University of Kansas, I took a paper that I had written and I used that paper as the basis for my proposal. So I had done a lot of work and I had a lot of preliminary estimates. And then I say, and here's how I'm going to build on this work. I recommend that people think about having, you know, 30 to 50% of the work done.
When you say like they want to fund things that are essentially feasible, that they the people that are reading these grants are like, this is definitely a project that can be done rather than a crazy idea. Sorry, let's not use the word crazy, but a wild idea that that could may or may not pan out.
I guess I have a question on strategy at that point. So I've heard similar versions of this piece of advice before, but it's never quite clear to me where to like, where to build in strategy here in the sense that like, there's things like, you know, you could do, but you are one resource away from being able to do. versus things you know you are going to do. And it would be nice if you could have like additional help pushing you there to get you there a little bit faster. I don't know if that distinction is clear. In my head, it might be clearer than the way that I described it. But like, is there room for like when should someone be strategic about things that like they could not do without this grant versus things that they like, this grant would like increase the probability of it being done?
Your motivation for getting a grant is you think you need the money to do it. And what I tell faculty and colleagues is that you always want the money, right? You know, we're not paid for 3 months out of the year. And so summer funding is really important. Grants are a signal of quality. They're a signal of that your research ideas have been vetted. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of the open science people are even arguing that if you get a grant funded, any output should already be automatically accepted in a journal.
Oh, wow.
Because it's already been peer reviewed, right?
Right.
That's and that would get prevent, I mean, their concern is about publication bias, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So say you do something, you propose something in a grant, it looks like a good idea, and you run the regression, it's like, you've got a null effect, right?
Right, if and it doesn't become public.
If you say, okay, you got NISF or NIH funding, we're going to publish your paper in this journal regardless, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Then you get out of the publication bias problem. So to go back to your point, Alex, when I write a project, you know, I have the idea, and then you have to have like a pilot study. You may have more work than that, but you know, economics requires lots of robustness checks mm-hmm. and lots mm-hmm. of extensions. And so you can talk about that in that paper as a rule of thumb, like a 3-paper proposal. So my proposal is going to have 3 specific aims. They're related this way, and this is how I'm going to do it. You have one that's really well developed, one that's partially developed, and then you can have one flyer that's kind of like, you know,
right,
more wild. But you'll have enough work done on the more developed things so that the mm-hmm. the people reviewing your work can see, oh yeah, this has mm-hmm. a lot of potential.
One thing that I felt like I was told when I was starting my junior scholar career is like, you know, not that don't apply to grants if you don't need them, but people would tell me like applying for grants is a huge time investment. Make sure that you're doing it because it's worth it or whatever. Is there any advice that you have on how to decide which grants to apply, which grants not to apply, or any kind of tips in that framework for deciding whether to not to invest your time in applying for a grant?
You know, it depends on the work you do. On average, economists don't need grants to do the research, right? But if you have to buy data or if you want to fund students, I have always felt that grants are a complement to research, not a substitute. I know that some people believe that there's a substitute. You know, if your project is funded, you've already got a strong signal that it's going to make a big contribution.
Okay, that's super interesting to know. I feel like I'm learning a lot. One thing, and maybe this is too broad of a question, but I'll ask it and let's see where that takes us, is you mentioned NSF, and I think you mentioned NIH. What are other places that people should be looking for grants, or is there a framework or how should you be looking for grants?
Well, economics is fortunate in like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, if you do health, funds a lot of health. The Sloan Foundation funds a lot of economics. Mm-hmm. The Kauffman Foundation used to fund entrepreneurship research. They don't really much anymore. Mm-hmm. Foundations are, the Gates Foundation sometimes does. Mm. Foundations are idiosyncratic. And you know, if I had more time, I'd write a paper about the incentives behind foundations. Because if you think about it, it's an interesting economics question. And I talked to Danny Goroff, who's at NSF now and also at the Sloan Foundation. So he wears a funding hat in 2 different worlds. You know, it's interesting because most foundations don't really have a budget constraint, right? Right. And we're, you know, the NSF has a budget constraint. NIH has a budget constraint. Mm-hmm. Foundations, the budget constraint is not really, it doesn't hit them as hard as it hits other organizations. Right. And so, I mean, it's a really interesting economic problem to think about the objective function behind a foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. So, go on.
So, I mean, you know, you can get them you know, some foundations, you know, can specialize and incentivize research that way because they have lots of money.
What broad advice would you give to a new faculty member or a graduating PhD student about how to write the most successful grant application possible? And I phrased it kind of carefully there because I'm not like, you should have in your mind, you're not going to get this grant, but you're going to increase the probability of all future grants by submitting this first thing.
Well, there's research, at least in health science and in biomedical research, that the process of writing a grant is productive for your career.
Oh,
so even if you don't get funded, the actual process, the fact that you applied for a grant, puts you in a better situation afterwards. So, you know, if I were talking to a PhD student, if your PhD student is a permanent resident or a US citizen, I would encourage them to write a dissertation grant itself. You know, you got the dissertation proposal sitting there, you're doing work on it, just take that idea and put it in as a grant, right? That the grant at that early stage is a signal. Right? It differentiates the student from the rest of the market. Their research went through the peer review process and was funded by the National Science Foundation. So that is something that I would strongly encourage PhD students to consider, or even like first year students can apply for the graduate research fellowship, where they have a research idea. And that pays for the cost of graduate school. For early career researchers, I say, you've got some research, you know, it's partly done. You take that and write it into a grant proposal. You keep working on the research. So you've taken maybe a week to take what is a research idea that you're working on and turn it into a proposal, submit the proposal, keep working, right? And you have a probability of getting paid in the summer, or using that money for course reductions, or using that money to buy data, or using that money to get graduate students. Again, it's a signal that your research resonates with the broader scientific community. It's not necessary, but I think it's beneficial to you. And it raises the profile of your work, right?
And what about like tips on the maybe the writing process? Like I think another thing that I have in my head is, you know, since you review potentially a lot of these grant applications, is there a common mistakes that our people are making or some sort of theme that we can learn from?
So I would say have a pilot study. If you're doing a theory, have some results. If you're doing empirical, have the data and preliminary regressions, you know. I'm an empiricist, so I'll have figures of the data, I'll have descriptive statistics. So they know that you're well on your way to doing the work. Okay. So you want to, again, the signal that you're trying to send is that this project is feasible. I've thought about the data. Done some preliminary analysis that suggests the following next 10 things that I'm going to do in this study.
That's so good to hear, because I feel like one of the things that as a junior person, I was always thinking is like, if I show them too much work, they're going to be like, well, why do you need this funding? But it's so counterintuitive to what you're saying, which is like, no, you actually have to show that you've done some work and that the work is feasible in order to be more successful at getting the grant.
Well, you don't take a paper, right? But you take a basic set of research questions, data, and preliminary results and say, look, this has potential. And then you build on that what the next paper would be, right? Because you thought about what this paper is going to be, but there's the next paper, right? And the next paper is related and it's going to do something different.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Thank you so much for all of this insight and advice today. Is there anything else that you want to add before we transition to the next part?
Well, if you're interested in getting a grant, find somebody who's been successful and asked to see a proposal, asked for their advice. Because even at NSF, within each part of NSF, there are going to be different types of reviewers and there are different ways that you have to frame it. So, you know, find somebody who's done something like what you want to do and ask for suggestions.
Every week we like to ask for our guests for a recommendation of the week. It could be anything at all. A command, a song, we do recipes and things frequently. What's your recommendation of the week? Do you have anything you'd like to share?
Can I do two? Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So the first one is, I had a colleague, he's left the university, but he did a lot of work and he found that if you go out in nature, you're more creative.
Oh, okay. I like that.
So if you're doing, and we started with camping, right? So
yeah.
Getting outside to kind of recharge your batteries every day, I think is really, really important, especially in the COVID world that we live in. So that would be my first overall just well-being piece of advice.
Mm-hmm.
And my second piece of advice, and it goes to workflow, experiment like three times where mm-hmm. I track what I spend my time on.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Research, teaching, service, 15-minute intervals every day.
Right.
Then you kind of look at it and count it how much you're actually working. I don't like include the time that I'm eating lunch and not working or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But count how much you're actually working and what you're working on. So mm-hmm. one time I did this and I realized I spent the previous month, 25% of my time the previous month answering mm-hmm. email.
Wow, that's intense.
And I wondered why I couldn't do research.
Those are good recommendations. Yeah. Alex, what about you? What's your recommendation of the week?
So my recommendation of the week is really similar to the closing advice that Donna was giving. And I did this. And again, I wasn't successful with the first grant that I submitted, but I just asked people I knew that had successful grants. And again, I had some relationship with them, but I think it would be even potentially okay if you didn't, to see their grants. And it made me, I literally had no idea what to do when I first submitted an NSF grant. So then I had these three or four, I forget the exact number, other grants, and it gave me a structure. I kind of had a clear idea of what to do because unlike a research article where there are many, you know, accepted published papers online, like you don't necessarily see accepted grant proposals. So I guess my tip is just to like double down on this recommendation to ask people that have had a successful grant. And then I guess while we're on it, I'll give a second one. I recently submitted all my promotion and tenure materials, and something that surprised me that was asked for was all of the submitted grants that I had done. So please do your future you a favor and just keep track of all that. Put a little tag in your email or however you're going to do it. Keep a document because it's something that I needed and took a long time to prepare.
My recommendation of the week is going to be twofold. So I definitely recommend applying for the grad students for the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship. And notice that you can apply as you're applying to grad school, one, but you can also apply while you're a first year graduate student as well. So I did not get it while on my application process, but I got it on the fall when I was doing my first year at Vanderbilt. And it was very helpful during my grad school career. I'm pretty sure my path would have been very different had I not received that grant because it allowed me not to TA for a couple of years, which was really helpful time-wise. So that will be my recommendation of the week to check that out. It is possible to get it. I know it sounds like really like far away and like, oh my gosh, I would never get it. I literally thought I would never get that grant because I was like, they're not going to give it to people like me. And just try it and follow the advice that you heard in this podcast and give it that. Great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
So I have a website. It's ipsr.ku.edu. That's the institute that I direct. And you can find out more about me at /bginther. That's my personal website.
Great. That's all we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.